Hello, this is William Scott, and following is an interview I did recently with Tan Staffel on the Brothers Grimm fairy tale, Snow White and Red Rose. The conversation went fairly long, about 2.5 hours, so I've broken it up into two sections. Also, I've made a trailer for Tan Staffel cast as well, in which I just make some introductory comments and my own current thinking on race realism and its implications. And without further ado, I hope you enjoy this conversation. Thank you.
Good evening. This is William Scott, and this is Folkways Podcast. Very pleased this evening to have with me Tan Staffel from Age of Treason radio and blog, and he's somebody I've felt very connected to over the last number of years. I think I first ran into his page could have been as early as 2008.
Yeah, I've been blogging at least that long. I think it was 2005 that I first started writing.
Okay, maybe it was even 2006. I mean, this is when I was kind of doing some 9/11 stuff back in those days and just kind of searching around, and then later in the last, I guess probably 2 years, and I've basically listened to everything on his site, and I find him to be a patient and yet furious commentator on the condition of Europeans in certainly in America, but also worldwide. So I'm very pleased to have him with me here this evening, and we will be discussing, as I want to do, fairy tales, but more particularly this fairy tale of Snow White and Red Rose, and even more so particularly focusing on the relationship between the bear in the story and the dwarf. If anyone wants to have the story read to them, I have a pod reading of that, will be on my Folkways WordPress site at the same time as this is going up. So that's kind of a nice way. It's not a terrible reading of it. And you can enjoy that or read it. But I mean, I think without knowing the story freshly, it's probably the conversation will be somewhat confusing. It's about a 16-minute read. So other than that, just welcome to the podcast, Tan Staffel.
Well, I'm glad to be here to meet you, to talk to you. I enjoyed your conversation with Ayla about this fairy tale, and I agree with you. I think your reading of it, it was about 16 minutes long. It's a short tale, and it's interesting, and it's also necessary to understand the context of what you and Ayla were talking about and what you and I are going to talk about. It's pretty much required reading or listening to, I think, put that up front and get so that we're all on the same page. We all know what we're talking about here.
Yeah. And then just these. I mean, this is just. I'm just beginning on these. I'm hoping to, to do several of them over the next while. It could be years even, but
it's a vein to be mined. It's a wonderful idea to explore Brothers Grimm and fairy tales in general, the archetypes of European mythology are there waiting to be tapped into and mined by us. And that was one of the things I enjoyed about your conversation, your back and forth with Ayla, was two intelligent people discussing this in a unfrightened way. And she mentioned it early on, how initially she avoided those tales. I don't want to put words in her mouth, but as I remember watching earlier today, she sensed when she was still a liberal that this was illiberal, that these tales were politically incorrect, and shied away from them at first. And it's only later that she embraced them.
Yeah. They are, it's only recently that I've kind of really come to understand what they are. I guess when I was younger, and even probably even until fairly recently, I assumed they were written by the Brothers Grimm. I thought they were just something they made up.
Right.
But this, there's sort of a pure I mean, not the purest, not in the truly pure sense, but they are. I mean, it's not like a religious document that's subjected to hierarchy or, you know, changing it so that it can be used in some kind of control. Or these are not the opiate of the masses. This is the, these are the wishes and dreams and experiences of the masses. So this is a fascinating documents. Before I saw them this way, I must say that, I mean, I was interested in them. I thought they were quaint and quirky, but when you see them in this way, it's quite elevating and quite overwhelming in a way too. I'm quite thrilled to be going down this path. I have a long way to go on, you know, background research and so forth, but I don't really know that we actually, in order to respond to them, I don't think we really need to. They probably speak to us on a primary level, but we can have a fruitful conversation.
Right, it's folk tales, really. It's an expression of the European psyche. I think it's not a sole product of the minds of these two brothers Grimm. It would probably be pretty good, even if it was just that, from that period of time and that place in Europe. But it is actually, as you say, a gathering of a collective consciousness, a European consciousness, the gathered wisdom. All of the collectively, these fairy tales represent that. And I thought it was also good and gave some focus to the conversation that you put one particular tale under the microscope and discussed the symbolism in that particular tale. And it was really, I don't know whether things I've said about feminism or the relationship between men and women influenced your thinking at all, but I heard basically your ideas about, and she echoed them as well, the relationship between men and women as two halves of a whole really resonated with me, really matched my understanding of not only how things have been and should be, but what's gone wrong is the distortion and the interference with that relationship. And that it's not really a feminist it's not a problem of feminism, and the answer is not a problem of men just stepping forward and saying you know, all we have to do is get out front and lead and the women will follow. I mean, there is a sense in which that's true, but it's you put it so well. I really recommend that people go and listen to your, for all its technical warts, that first interview that you did and that first discussion that you had is valuable context for this discussion that we're having. And you did a fantastic job on that particular point of expressing what you thought had gone wrong. And that tale, the Snow White and Red Rose, is what inspired that. And I think if you're going to do this for a while yet and get into lots of different tales, you're going to find lots and lots of themes that are really good for Europeans to think about and dwell on.
Yeah, this is interesting. Yeah, I was just actually listening to Red Ice, actually Radio 314, and Lana talking to an academic woman about Slavonic mythology. And there's very little material. And so... But they didn't talk about the folk tales, so I'm curious whether or not, because these tales carry the story of our people deep back, so we may have lost the kind of the top upper mythology, but we haven't lost the lower mythology, the mythology of the people. And so for me, this this kind of oppressive, as one of my other earlier videos and will be a podcast said that I mean, really why I'm doing the channel, what I really want to do is to smash this notion that we don't have an identity or a culture as European people. I mean, we can break that down into different kinds of European people and will do that, but in general as well, this idea is a pernicious lie, and it has been what has caused us to be unsettled and able to be kind of thrown off our footing. So that's
yes, Yeah, I agree. And even somebody as young and as inexperienced as Dylan Roof put his finger on that, that he had a very insightful way of putting it. He said, like, our culture has become the world culture, really, and that's why we don't recognize it. I forget the exact passage. I should have been more prepared. But you surprised me with this observation. It's true. It is a lie that we don't have a culture. We have a very, very rich culture. And that's one of the things that I enjoyed about my experience at the White Network and the delving I did into white history and white identity was the discovery of white music and white ethnic consciousness or a racial history. There are men and women who have appreciated this in the past and have called attention to it. And it's not gone either. It's just buried. Some of it is all around us. And unfortunately, a lot of the sickest stuff is, the McDonald's that you can find everywhere, or the even something as simple as the necktie and the suit, has become, or English as the lingua franca of the world. Mm-hmm. Those things are good examples of how, and that's specifically Anglo too, Anglo-Saxon culture spreading around the world. It's a mark of success in a way, but it's also kind of sick. The McDonald's part of it especially makes me feel bad, actually, about the way it's happened. But the Brothers Grimm and fairy tales in general are one of those things that's a very positive element of our culture that we will find nothing but joy and goodness, I think, in mining there and in digging there and trying to understand what those tales have to tell us.
Yeah, and I think even more than I think even more than they are themselves, these stories are a document, a representation of our culture through time. But they also, if we allow them to, they revive in us our virtues.
Yeah.
So that we aren't just fast food eaters or whatever, right? It isn't just junk culture. I mean, that was the real hope that I had in this one particular story. It really kind of revived my hope in the cause, because it told me that this has happened before.
Yeah,
we've been here before so many times that there's an archetypal story. there's this metaphorical story to talk about decline, confusion, spell cast, breaking of spell, and restitution. Renaissance.
There's something similar in the Greeks, where they long ago had realized the cycle of politics from democracy to from republic to democracy to tyranny to revolution, and then around again. And mm-hmm. And that was thousands of years ago. They already realized that. So. This is deep stuff. It's just waiting for us to uncover it and to talk about it, think about it. I recalled, your blog itself is called Folkways, and your podcast here, you mentioned the last time that you're thinking about changing that name because it's a conflict with somebody else's name. But yeah. About Folkways, I first came across that, it must be a little more than a year ago now. I'm starting a new podcast series I was calling Race and Jews, and something Kevin MacDonald had written about ethnocentrism came to my attention, how the term ethnocentrism was coined by an anthropologist about 100 years ago named William Graham Sumner. And Folkways was a big part of that. He wrote, there's a little snippet here I'd like to read because I think it's valuable. Loyalty to the group. He's trying to define ethnocentrism now. Loyalty to the group, sacrifice for it, hatred and contempt for outsiders, brotherhood within, warlikeness without, all grow together, common products of the same situation. It is sanctified by a connection with religion. Men of an others group are outsiders with whose ancestors the ancestors of the we group waged war. Each group nourishes its own pride and vanity, boasts itself superior, exalts its own divinities, and looks with contempt on outsiders. Each group thinks its own folk ways the only right ones, and it observes that the other groups have other folk ways. These excite its scorn. So that's the context of folk ways that and our folk ways, our European folk ways, excite the scorn of aliens. Mm-hmm. They alienate them. You know, that's something you can see every day when you read the Jewish media or view it or listen to it. You can basically detect the dripping with scorn of it toward whites, toward Europeans, the unsympathetic attitude that's right there. It's in the tone of and the attitude of every story that's reported, even if it's supposedly a straight news story. It's given with a slant to it that's anti-European, anti-white.
It's hard to have this conversation without appearing arrogant or hubristic, but it's clearly envy. It really is the only kind of explanation for it. And we're sort of the doleful noble in a way. We sort of plod along. We're not kind of aware of it. We want to pretend that we don't even exist in a way, and we want to. And yet there's this. And yet, just in the sum total of our actions is still prosperity, wealth, stability, right? These are the sum total of our actions in terms of our culture, cultural participation, and cultural building.
Yeah.
And then, that is others want that. I mean, we're seeing this in Europe right now, and yet they want it and disdain us at the same time, and they want to take it or pretend that they could have made it if we hadn't somehow done it instead. I'm not really quite sure. I mean, then there's these kind of crazy stories that we've sort of stole everything that we have, but it's envy. And that's
right. Well, there's actually
to come on side with us. I mean, that's the hard reality.
There's two lines that they take to attack us and undermine our confidence and detach us from our history and from our racial consciousness. And the first is that it doesn't exist. The claim that, you know, you don't exist, this idea of white, you know, who's white anyway. It turns out, of course, if you do dig into the details, there is a rational, reasonable explanation, a scientific, genetic, biological, as well as these folk tales, spiritual type of connection that Europeans have with each other. There is a real sense in which we are we. And it's complex. There are different levels of we and different subsets of we, but there is a superset that you can certainly rationally call white or European. But that's one way that they attack it, is by basically telling us that we don't exist, we're not real, we don't have a culture, that kind of stuff. And then the second thing that they do, that it's also an attack, but it's an attack that actually contradicts the first attack, and that is, you're responsible for all the problems. You white people are the ones who colonized the world and who raped all the cultures of the world and who are ruining the world and are to blame for Ferguson, to blame for Baltimore, to blame for whatever. You know, whatever happens, it's whose fault is it? It's white people's fault. And it totally contradicts the first line of attack that they use against us. White exists.
Much like the dwarf, who forever blames the other, his other, right? He never takes responsibility for his own actions, even though he's constantly screwing up. You know, he himself can't even do work. He can't do any menial work without messing it up.
Your conversation with Ayla was very good, and she mentioned that it was actually the dwarf character, despite the fact that he looked human, was actually the inhuman character in the tale, and that the bear, who was actually just the prince who had been by a spell turned into a bear, was, in spite of the fact that he didn't look human, was human. And she called him the other, the dwarf, was an other, an obvious other, and that what characterized him was his greed. And she actually identified his the parasitism of that character, the nature of it being something that something that only wanted to take, and how can you help me, unabashedly demanding to be helped, and yet never giving anything in return of value. And I thought that that was interesting, because it's yet another example. I see these examples all over the place of people who are talking about parasitism, the symptoms of parasitism, and either they don't realize it or they won't make the connection directly to Jews as the parasite. And in this case, I think that, yes, the dwarf can be seen not only as a parasitic other type of character, but can be seen as an archetype, or I don't know what the proper word for it is in storytelling, but as the as a Jew, as a stand-in for a typical Jew. And these tales are, as distilled wisdom, are a boiling down of the European experience with Jews. And just one thing to add to what Ayla said was that the way that the dwarf goes about demanding, it doesn't just say, well, give me this or give me that. It actually berates the people. That's the psychological trick that it uses to manipulate them, is and I've noticed this the last few months. I've been thinking about how it actually works, that these Jews are so nasty and so demanding and so insulting. That is how it works. There's an element of what comes to mind is master and slave, and how the master that is kind to its slave, that doesn't work as well. Maybe in the long term it does, but in the short term at least, a master that beats its slave and tells its slave, you're lazy, you need to work harder, you need to do this, you need to do that, because you're not serving me well enough. The immediate response of that slave, if it feels its situation is hopeless and it can't fight back, as most slaves do, is to try harder, to slave even harder for them and try to please the master even harder. And I saw that element in this very short story, the 16-minute long story. It's just a few minutes or a few seconds of dialogue there. But you can see this in the way that the dwarf just berates the little girls that it wants to help him. And then when they do help him, it berates them for the way that they helped him. And is insulting. I saw actually a racial animus there from the dwarf and the storyteller. It wasn't coming from the girls directly, but the girls also the storyteller told or described the dwarf in unsympathetic terms. So
yeah. There's something with this something in there too about what's often referred to as pathological altruism. With these girls and the mother too, but she less to the dwarf. She has no relationship with the dwarf directly, but she does open the door to the bear without kind of worrying. But in this case, it was not just a virtue, but it actually, in the case of the bear, it worked out in the end, right? The bear is
right. I actually had that thought right at the beginning of the story when she lets the bear in. I thought to myself, well, wait a minute. That's, you know, this is not all that good. This is not a good moral to teach people to let bears into their house. But the deeper subtext there, I think, was that first of all, in the end of the tale, you find out that the bear is the hero or the good guy. And secondly, there's an unspoken element of the woman uses her judgment and she uses her intuition and to judge whether this is a good idea or not. And we have these instincts. We use it on the internet, as odd as that may seem in the context of talking about a fairy tale. But today on the internet, where we're meeting strangers, and I imagine that when people listen to someone like me speak on a podcast or something, that they're trying to evaluate, who is this guy? You know, they don't know me personally, and I'm kind of cagey about my
We know your hands very well.
My name and my address. Those are my hands. It is my voice speaking. And before I went online and started speaking with my voice, I was typing and writing my thoughts out and interacting with people that way. And I know myself from trying to figure out who I'm interacting with on the internet, that there are ways to get a sense of who you're communicating with, especially over a long period of time with quite a bit of communication. You get a better and better sense if this person thinks the way you do. And one of the points I've made many times, I'll make it again here, is that the Jews are racially different than Europeans. And what that means is not just genetically different, not just different looking in surface ways, but also personality-wise. We have a different mix of personality traits. And a European can sense when they're talking to somebody who is a European. There's that famous quip about, you know, nobody knows you're a dog on the internet. Yeah, if they're only exposed to you for 30 seconds or one sentence anonymous comment somewhere, it's hard to tell who's who. But over a period of time, when you interact with somebody, you can get a sense. And back to the story, the woman who lets the bear into the house, I assume in that condensed style in which these fairy tales are written, that a whole chapter has been reduced down to a single sentence there, where the woman does feel satisfied by her intuition that this bear is okay. She got the right signals, pheromones, whatever it is, and said and figured out that this guy is okay. Even though he looks like a bear, he's all right, and my daughters will be safe around him. And immediately the story gets into exactly that the bear turns out to be a friendly companion, very playful. And I loved Ayla's point. She saw in that the relationship with the male figure, the father, and the little kids, you know, grabbing onto its leg and grabbing onto the father's leg brought back memories of my own kids when they were real small.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, it was quite. Yeah, exactly that. I would probably say I think maybe the girls did it more than the boys too. There is that. She's quite insightful, that woman. I'm very happy to have her.
Yeah.
Have her on.
I've seen videos too where little cubs, little tiger or lion cubs will crawl all over the bigger tiger or lion, and mm-hmm. you know, it's obvious that the bigger animal is just tolerating the little ones in a playful way.
And, yeah, it's a way of proving that though you have the strength, you won't use it inappropriately.
Right, and this gets to the point I was making about the woman having an intuition. Children seem to have that intuition too. Even before they're verbal, they seem to sense when they can trust an adult, even though this big, hulking, bear-like monster obviously could hurt them very badly if it wanted to. They get a sense pretty quickly that who they can trust and who they can't. And lo and behold, psychological tests, in fact, you know, this is, we're hearing it from the enemy now, the point of view that we're born racist because even before we can speak, white children, and these studies are almost always focused on analyzing white people's racism. They go into it with that premise that they're going to uncover it. What they're really uncovering, of course, is this human instinct and capacity to sense and discriminate self from other, us from them.
The shame of this this anti-racism that we've lived under, especially in the institution, right, in the university, and in the scientific community. I mean, it'd be one thing enough if it's just, you know, just the kind of pop cultural reality, and yet, you know, work is still being done in the universities, is that we just don't, you know, there's a lot of information that we really could know by now that we don't know because the work hasn't been allowed to be done. And when we talk about racial differences in terms of these very things you're talking about, in-group, out-group, and how we relate, I mean, we have very particular ways of doing that. On the one hand, we do have an intuition of racial camaraderie with our folk, But we are also able to be kind of run a script, a propositional script that allows us to include others in that.
Yes.
In a kind of way. But it's really ultimately what we're doing, and this is what's going on in Europe right now, and what's going on in with this whole multicultural, which is really an oppressive monoculture and a continuation of colonization from my perspective.
Something about colonization.
Prior to that, we don't have the data to show, you know, research to show that how we do respond in these ways. So we could be, because we do respond to information well. You know, it is part of our disposition to have data, facts. In fact, that's a very white way of being, is to respond with high morality, high functioning morality, based on what we believe to be true.
Well, universalism. It's this willingness. It's one of these personality traits I'm talking about, this willingness to step outside ourselves and think in a general way, to generalize about things. And there's a bit of, it's called projection by Freud and psychologists, but it's positive projection in this case. We tend to think, it's a basic psychological error, I think, in white people especially, that we think other people are just like us. You know, and even in this little snippet of text I read about William Graham Sumner's definition of ethnocentrism, this is a European defining this and imagining that other people are kind of like Europeans, but different. We'll go as far as to say, yes, there are different groups here, but we won't imagine, we have trouble imagining, I should say, that, for instance, Jews are not just a different group, but think differently and put different priorities on things. For instance, you know, truth telling seems to be very, very important to Europeans. Whereas with Jews, you know, the truth is whatever's good for the Jews. That's the truth. That's how they define truth. It's not about testing empirically the reality around you and then going with whatever you detect. I mean, they can do that to a certain extent if they have some, like, how to manipulate people. You know, they are very scientifically oriented that way in figuring out what really does work on mass psychology and what doesn't. In that respect, yeah, they're very, very willing to deal with facts and science. But when it comes to real science about who we are, the anthropology that in the last 100 years white people have lost control over and is dominated now by Jews, that's how it happened, is Jews were willing to just flat out lie about stuff, even when it came to hard science. And in the case of anthropology, it's not quite a hard science like physics or mathematics is, but it's not a total soft science like, that's one of the ways that they were able to subvert anthropology was by taking what at the time was physical anthropology based on physical relics, archaeology, even linguistics, I would consider fairly hard data. And they shifted it to a cultural anthropology based on narrative. And I was having a conversation with a friend earlier today, and he pointed out, you know, basically in the United States, one of the ways that they took over the United States was they didn't need to change the Constitution as the way the document is written, the way it was even built into it, that it could be modified by, you know, amending it and so forth. They changed the meanings of words, or they read whole sections of meaning in between lines of the existing document. And it's, I see this over and over. This is a pattern with the Jews of how they do what they do is they literally define the terms in which we think and speak. And they redefine them. If right now what's going on in Europe is they're busy redefining what it means to be a German, what it means to be a European. It's not instantaneous. It's been actually a project decades long that they've been changing it so that, you know, it's not blood and soil nationalism. It's not based on who you were born to or where you were born. But nationalism is now anybody who can sneak across the border becomes, you know, an American. Anybody who sneaks across the border can become a German or a Swede. And they, how do they make this happen? By just repetition and by owning the megaphone, by being the ones who broadcast their point of view over and over and over again until people accept it.
Backing up, sorry to cut you off. I think you were finishing there.
Done. I went a little bit off the path.
I'm just thinking when you were talking earlier about how we tend to project out. I think maybe all groups do in a way, right? So if you're in a race,
that's a projection too. I'm not so sure that other groups do even think that deeply about it. The best way to understand other groups is that they think like the Jews do. What's best for us?
Just hold that for a sec. But I'm just thinking that because they want to belong to whatever society they happen to show up in, right? Because Jews want to be able to be, and this is always what they're complaining about, is that why can't we just be here? Why is it that you want to be so mean, and why is it some people don't want us around? So for them, other people, of course. As soon as they arrived on the boat, they were an American. Of course, anybody else coming must also be, right? So partly it may be conscious, but partly it may just be a projection out of themselves, seeing the other as themselves. But anyway, that may not hold. But let's I just wanted to talk about something here about a couple things, or bring us kind of back to the story a little bit, maybe a little more concretely. We're looking at this spell, and I guess that's really kind of what we've been talking about. And to me, this is a great metaphor for just symbol for talking about this whole problem of loss of identity, of just being in kind of a state of confusion. And I like the fact that it reduces us in a sense to animal nature. We're not able to, we're not our full potential. We are just the beast, and in a sense, talking more religiously or symbolically about human beings. I mean, this is a common thing. We're the angelic beast, as it were, right? We have these high functioning capacities, and we also have still this animal nature that comes along with us. But in this state that the prince is in, he has become under this spell. Now, when I was younger and heard these stories, I always would have thought, well, okay, I'm going to introduce a conversation here for you to, or a point for you to spring off of here, is that, that spell was kind of being cast on that person. Whereas when I'm reading this here, I'm sort of thinking that in some way we make the mistake of we're getting something in the initial state and or continuously getting something that keeps us under the spell. Interesting conversation. I've heard you talk before about, how much of this is pathological altruism, how much of this is what we, our own mistake versus something that's being done to us. And this story really has that kind of so... turning around on itself. It's difficult to, as much as it's difficult to say, extract maybe the difference of opinion, the differences you've drawn between, say, Kevin MacDonald, sometimes you think is overly emphasizing the pathological altruism and versus the viciousness of the, I mean, that's the initial, when the dwarf is first introduced, he's introduced as the wicked dwarves. So, how much of it is, and this story, in a way, gives us, I think it gives us kind of both indications. So anyway, just let you respond to that.
Yeah, I thought that was a very insightful point that you and Ayla brought up in the last, when you discussed it, was this issue of responsibility and who's responsible, given that it is a spell cast upon the white people or the white man by the evil, the wicked dwarf. And I did see how it maps into our current situation. And just to make it clear, the magic in our case is the mainstream mass media, the television, Hollywood, movies, all of this stuff. I mean, literally, we've got a situation today where our fairy tales, our ancient myths, are being retold now in the form of movies, blockbuster movies made by Jews. And they are redefining them. Yes, they're inserting non-white characters into these things and saying, you know, when people get upset about it and say, hey, wait a minute, that's cultural appropriation or whatever, or I just don't like it, then they're dismissed as, you know, somehow psychologically defective. You know, they're racist or whatever to insist or to be disturbed by that. But it is a very disturbing, it's a very fundamentally disturbing thing to see your people's very myths undermined in such a way and perverted in such a way, hijacked. I think also just about earlier this year, I mean, it was about 6 months ago, earlier the past year, I should say, back in June, I wrote a post called Solipsism and Narcissism, where I talked a little bit, one of the elements there that was actually very pleasing. It was another another experience where I ran across a European myth and archetype of Narcissus, the character that most people are familiar with the word narcissism and this sort of unhealthy pathological individualism, you could call it, or a pathological self-focus. The myth is that the man is so enamored with his own beauty that he's looking at himself in a pool and falls into it and drowns and dies. So his self-absorption is actually fatal. And that's the context I brought it up in. But what I discovered when I came across it, that narcissists is actually encouraged in this behavior by another mythological creature, Nemesis, which is the Jew in our modern understanding of what's going on here. And it's not there is a tendency for one of the things that white people, one of our personality traits is to take responsibility. We seem to be willing to take responsibility, although there's a certain amount of false taking of responsibility where it's actually, I'm going to take responsibility for my race and blame them for the problem. It's not really me, see, because I'm wise enough to see what the problem is. But everyone else who's white has a problem. And even in some of what I'm talking about, you could see maybe an element of that as if I'm looking down on my own race. But I'm just trying to be realistic here that we do seem to have this tendency to want to generalize, to step outside ourselves, be objective. It's part of what enabled us to do science. But it also is, I think it's the same psychological tendency that makes us want to think that we're the only people in the room, that we're the only, and that's where the solipsism comes in. I called it racial solipsism, or ultimately I called it pathological ethnocentrism, where we think we're the only thing with agency. We're the only group that has agency, but there's nothing we can do about how Jews behave, and we can't change them. So this is one of the excuses I hear about, you know, why we shouldn't bother even talking about the Jews, because there's nothing we can do to change them. So the only way we can solve the problem is to change ourselves. Well, if the problem is burned into our genes, as I think, you know, the basic element of our personalities is burned into our genes, we're not going to be able to literally change it like genetically, but the power, the change that needs to happen is in our heads, is in our thoughts. And that is actually something that you can change in a split second. And for a racial awakening, when people racially awaken, it does happen that quickly. I mean, there's fallout and there's still all sorts of crashing noises for months after you come to the realization. But when you decide, or I don't even think it is a conscious decision, but when it finally, the straw breaks the camel's back in your mind and you realize I'm white, there's nothing I can do about it, and I've got to fight, it all happens very, very quickly. And very quickly after that, at least in my experience, was I realized, well, not only am I white and I'm in a fight, but there are other people, my enemy, who I can't control, but they are aggressing against me and my people. And there is something I can do about that. I can, you know, alert people to this threat. It's not just white people killing ourselves. It's not like we control the society and we're pulling all the levers that are exterminating ourselves. I'm recapitulating now, getting a little excited thinking about this whole my anger really at this whole pathological altruism, white suicide argument that I've actually spent the first half of the year criticizing and taking apart. And I think I'm gratified that I think it wasn't really my effort. It was the reality on the ground in what's going on in Europe, the invasion of Europe, that sort of demonstrated that this is not pathological altruism that's driving it. There's an element of it that the media likes to hype of the German people with flowers and teddy bears meeting the refugees, holding signs saying refugees welcome. But there's also a very, very strong element of people who are seething, who do not want this, who didn't ask for it, and who would go out with their butcher knives if that's all they could get, and would fight this themselves, but they are literally repressed by their own, and it's not theirs, obviously, but their own people who have been co-opted into the police and into the army and answer to people like Angela Merkel, who give them whose heads, the program running in their heads, is a Jewish program of got to protect the non-whites, got to protect the other, got to protect the Jew. Who all of those other things are just basically proxies for. You know, the Syrian refugee and the Jews themselves made it pretty clear during the months of this summer when they were writing op-eds saying, oh, as a Jew, I know what it's like to be a refugee because my parents or my grandparents or my great-grandparents all were refugees when they came to this country. And isn't it wonderful that I am here today so that I can argue that your country should have to take these refugees? And as a Jew, you know, putting their Jewishness right there as the moral of the story, or as the moral imperative of their argument.
Yeah, it seems to be far more open than I've recognized in the past. I mean, there was even an article.
Yeah, well, it was it was as open as the dwarf saying, hey, you stupid girls, get over here and help me. And, oh, I don't like the way you're helping me. You should be helping me harder or something. And
you should help me.
Oh, you're so odious.
Help me more gently, but
yeah.
Better. Don't,
well,
tear
call
my coat.
Them.
Don't tear my coat when the eagles try to take me away.
And I love how the girls, he called them odious and uncouth while they're
odious.
Helping him.
Odious, I know. Odious. Odious in that toadstool. There's some cursings in there I don't quite understand.
Well, that's what the Jews do. I mean, that's the way they behave. You, when you read one of these op-eds, they're telling you how terrible Europeans are, how they really hate Europeans. They really despise Europeans. And by the way, you Europeans, you need to open your borders. You need to not put any restrictions on these people in any way whatsoever.
Yeah,
while they're insulting you.
We created the wealth. And the surplus, right, which is envied and desired. And then, yeah, when you talk about pathological altruism, this disposition is less about, it's not the driver, but much like the surplus and everything else, it's one of the wealths in a way. It's one of the conditions in which they can act and maybe not consciously, but they can expect us to respond in a way that is ultimately to their favor, never enough to their favor, always a complaint that we haven't done enough or that we're a bunch of Nazis or something, even though, you know, our people are bending over backwards and allowing ourselves to be diluted on our own turf, you know? And so this altruism that we have, I don't see it as a driver so much. I mean, maybe for a handful of people, it's the driver for this mass immigration thing and this invasion in Europe. But I see it more as a kind of a trusted disposition that they know they could act. And if we didn't have it, we wouldn't be having this conversation, right?
I think it's a cover story.
What's that?
I think it's a cover story. I think that's what the media would like us to – that's how they would like us to behave, is to open all of our doors and welcome the other. That is one of the main themes of the moral of the stories of so many movies and so many news reports, is that this is the way you should behave Goyim. You need to open your doors. You need to open your wallets. You need to be generous. And because it will make you feel good and will make everybody will think you're a great person if you do that. That's what I mean when I say it's the cover story. It is what, how we are supposed to behave. Mm-hmm, that's mm-hmm. what the purpose of the moral of the story is of their having hijacked the narrative now that's being broadcast to everyone. That is the moral that they're trying to impart to us. It's a mistake for us to accept it and say, well, this is coming from within us, ourselves. I'm sure there is a little bit of that. And that's why it resonates with Europeans, especially is because there is a frequency in us that is tuned to that it will resonate with and cause us specifically to behave that way. Because the Muslims and whatever, all the other aliens amongst us are tuned into the same television as we are. So there must be some frequency tuning there that the message ends up being mostly poisonous to us. Although there is blowback. I mean, Jews themselves are, some individual Jews are caught up in this and end up doing these destructive behaviors and other non-whites also. But it does, my argument against pathological altruism isn't that pathological altruism doesn't exist. It's that it's not explaining, and you seem to understand this, it's not the driving force behind things. What's the driving force? The driving force is racial animus. It's competition between two separate groups. And the clash between us is the alienation that you could see between any alien groups. And furthermore, I don't make the mistake of saying, well, the Jews are just like us. They're just a different people, like, say, William Graham Sumner would say. I say that, in my view, looking at history, all the way back, including these Brother Grimm tales, the Jews are in a superior position to us in a sense that they are conscious. They are far more conscious of themselves as a group, of their history, and of their interests as a group, and they are willing to do whatever it takes. I mean, even when they have a servant in the White House as servile as Obama, that still doesn't make most of them happy. They still whine and complain that he's a Jew-hater and he needs to do this and he needs – and I think about the master whipping the slave and getting even more out of him, or the dwarf berating the two sisters to get them to work even faster to free him and serve him. This is why they have won. This is why they are on top, because they are absolutely relentless even when they're on top. Whereas white people tend to, you know, be self-absorbed and contented. When the minute we hit some affluence, we become lazy and complacent and are able to be taken advantage of, as we have been.
I'm thinking here about a couple things. I don't know if I can get them all out before I forget some of them. But you're talking about our ability to kind of stand outside, this ability to stand outside ourselves and look at things, to be disinterested. And this is one of the things that has led those of us who have that in spades to be able to do things like science and
yes,
to observe disinterestedly. It seems, therefore, there is the possibility then, the future possibility that we can stand outside. And I think that's why you and I and others have this capacity to stand outside this racial animus or this racial conflict and understand that it is a racial conflict.
Yes.
What you're doing is universalizing, meaning the way I stand outside is to see everyone as the same. Well, that's only one way of standing outside. There's another way to stand outside and to see the groups and say, oh, okay, well, I actually see that this group has a whole different way of conceiving the world, because they're a small group, but they're not a small group that wants to have a little country. They're a small group that likes to be at the top. And so therefore they need a huge, bear on which or kingdom on which to feed off of, right?
Yeah.
Because they don't have, they on their own, they don't have enough wealth and power. They don't have enough people. They don't have enough ground. And if they did, then they would actually, if they somehow were to proliferate, to have a couple of centuries of fecundity, they would actually have to change, because they wouldn't, right? You know what I mean? They are what they are because, in two ways. One, because of how they are in the world. And secondly, that by being that in the world, they replicate that. That those are the ones that survive. Those are the ones that thrive. So they have, and they've thrived this way for a long time. And this is why I say McDonald's work and some this kind of disinterested view of it. It's not like, you know, the protocols or something, or some kind of, you know, they get a tweet every morning on what they're supposed to do. It's just simply a function. Now, some might be more conscious than others, as with us. Sometimes we're conscious, sometimes we're not conscious. But this brings me to the next point that I want to insert some kind of hope that this parable gives to me, is that, you know, if the story has been told before, it's not how it finishes. And we do talk about how that we're kind of asleep in a way. And again, the story tells us under a spell. We are not as aware. But I think those of us who are waking up to this stuff are actually the more awake. I think we're more awake than even George Soros. We are the most awake. And in the cycle of this cultural cycle, it doesn't mean we're gonna end it. It's where we are in the cycle. It's actually the opportunity to be the most awake. I mean, it's kind of a bummer. I mean, if you're in a time of prosperity and you're just whatever you're doing, or you're the yeoman, or if you're the king, or you're the whatever, and there isn't a lot of you're just kind of you're floating. You're kind of asleep in your own prosperity. I mean, God bless them. I wish I were there, right? We're not there. We're here, but we have this opportunity to be awakened to something more that we are. And in a sense, there is some good, some purging of nonsense in this process, right? We aren't able to just kind of be, we can't just return to where we were just previously, even before the 19th century. And you talk about anthropology. I mean, the discipline had started for what, 2 decades, and then it was hijacked that quickly because it was so important as a discipline, right? I mean, you talk about a discipline of great importance in terms of informing people of who and what they are. I mean, they immediately took hold of that. And
there really isn't any more important science than the science of understanding who you are and where you came from, your own objective history as to who you are. And which is what anthropology is about.
So just for me to finish up my point real quick here about what the story is telling me is that, you know, we do awaken, and we do have a renaissance, and we do become the golden man.
Right, and we do it by just simply swatting the dwarf. And it is that simple in this story. Again, a whole chapter reduced to a single sentence, or there's more to it than that. But and I think that is the optimism to the situation, that the way I see it, it's sort of like that. You know, step one, do this. Step two, do that. And step three is profit, or some mystery, and then step four is profit. The solution to the problem here, I don't know what it is ultimately, but it's at least it involves, first of all, recognizing that we have an enemy that needs to be confronted as an enemy and not just ignored because we can't change them. And after all, they're just a tiny minority. In this parable or this fairy tale, the dwarf is powerful enough to cast a spell that transforms the prince into a bear. But in the end, the spell is broken relatively simply in a single sentence, a single act of swatting the dwarf. The metaphor for us is that it is that easy to break the mental chains that the Jews have put on us. But after the mental chains, after the psychological tricks and the mumbo jumbo, the magic that they use on us, the media and the brainwashing, if you get past that, then comes pain. then comes financial threats, then comes threats against your life, ultimately, for the people who go the farthest and potentially do the most damage. And even if you're able to organize an army of millions, as the National Socialists did in Germany, the Jews still will put up a fight, will organize other goyim to do their bidding and to destroy you. And so we have to be mindful of that, that it's not going to be simple and it's not going to be easy, but it can be done. So there is that aspect to it that's...
ultimately, it's as simple as waking up tomorrow and making decisions for your folk. I mean, it's really as simple as that. I mean, the things would correct themselves if you had enough self-aware white people. And I think we could be on the cusp of that. I mean, often there's this despairing conversation, but I mean, I think some people have maybe made their identity out of being in opposition, as probably all of us have in a way. I've kind of seen myself as an outsider a good deal of my life. I really felt associated with the culture that I grew up in. I did and I didn't. It's kind of mixed. But that the need to and again, I lost my thought.
Well, I agree with you that there's different people will react differently to the knowledge, but and it will be better to do this or that depending upon the different situation that each person is in. But the first thing is to give people that knowledge. It's a terrible, it's like that Matrix metaphor of waking up and reality isn't the nice, clean reality you thought, that this awakening process of coming to an understanding of reality is unpleasant in that sense. But it gives you then at least more control over your life and being able to do things intelligently. So that at least I think about the medical motto of do no harm that doctors swear by. It allows you to do that. For me personally, once I realized what was going on, I saw that I was actually helping to fuel it by making so much money, working a corporate high-paying job and paying so much in taxes that they were using that tax money against me, and I immediately scaled back what I was making, and basically I bounced along the poverty line as I am now, scaled way back. And that's and other things go along with that. You know, stop watching television, or when you watch television or Jewish media, that you're aware of the poisonous message, and so you're basically inoculated to it. I think Ayla mentioned that a bit too, is that her kids, by being exposed to these Grimm's fairy tales and the morals of these stories, were in a way inoculated from the sick, degenerate morals that are being spread right now.
Kevin McDonald talks about that, the pathologizing our virtues. I mean, nothing could be more heinous than what the Frankfurt School psychologists and social engineers did, was to take our very goods, the best good of ourselves, those things which resonate in our souls as confirming righteousness, goodness, virtue, and calling them vices.
Yes. Weaknesses. Well, even something as simple. If you want borders, if you want a country and you want to have borders in that country, that's xenophobia. The Jews have psychopathologized everything that's normal and healthy and necessary to continue as a group, as a species or a subspecies. Everything that you need to survive, they have psychopathologized, if not outright outlawed, as hate. There's a metaphor that I spotted in the story, and it's related to your two halves of the same whole when you were talking about men and women. And I thought it also applies to the relationship of this prince with the ordinary folk. And one of the ways in which the Jews have gotten control is divide and conquer. And they've divided us by class. And class is such a vulgar word for it. In my mind, I see something larger. The aristocracy, really, they've divided and they've played the aristocracy against the rest of the folk to the point where, all of the, in this particular story, it's not so bad that the princess merely turned into a bear, and the bear turns out to be pretty friendly anyway, but he is estranged from his own people at the very least. And he's not really turned back into a prince and put in his proper place until the end, until the spell is smashed. The dwarf is smashed and the spell is dispelled. But that is part of what's happened to us historically, is that our natural aristocracy, our natural leaders have been decapitated, have been either co-opted, and I don't mean to excuse any of the ones who have betrayed us, because that there's an element of that too, that some of them were not just the spell that was cast on them was to tap into their own personal.
Yeah, I would see it as the dwarf includes more than Jews. I would say that it's there, and certainly doesn't include all Jews also, but it includes it's a greed function that is gone wild, but it is also an other, and any time our people choose to other us I've got some historical speculations, I won't get into that, but I mean basically our aristocracy was removed from the folk. I mean, and traditionally in our smaller tribal setting, you know, the rulers, the kings, they had to impress the people in order to get those positions. At some point, they're just hereditary, they're just power, and then the people are groveling below them. So in those periods of time, that isn't really a naturalist aristocracy. It's a parasitic aristocracy. They're functioning parasitically themselves, right? Because they're feeding off of this body politic without nurturing that body of people. And in a sense, in the democratic system that we have, that it's just continuous. There is no end to it. Whereas in another form of system, you may actually have a virtuous leader come to be, but whereas it's almost impossible in democracy to have a virtuous leader in the current manifestation anyway, possibly, but I don't see it happening. Maybe Trump. I don't know. The glorious leader is the DS calls him.
The leaders of today are not representative of what we've had in the past. The stable forms of governance were all based on a quid pro quo of the aristocracy is above, and it merits that position because they are better, and the people they give their support to the aristocracy, the leaders, but it isn't unconditional. It's based on a this for that, that the leadership, then the aristocracy, protects its people. And an aristocracy that was not willing to protect its people, that would sell out its people, was soon out of power itself. And to the extent that it was a hereditary power at all, well, that meant that they were cutting their own children's future and off as well. And today, that doesn't even seem important, because that's one of the main ways that they've undermined us is by convincing us that to even think about your children or your race, your extended family, as being important, that's racist. That's a psychological problem, you don't want to think that way. So, and at the same time, they glorify, you know, getting rich and getting successful and being a celebrity. And so, you know, Trump is actually, there are some ways in which he is, an expression of Aryan physique and strong headedness and self-confidence. But there are other ways in which, you know, his focus on his metric for success and for what's good and what isn't is basically money and business success. And that is part of how we've gotten to where we are, how we've been corrupted, is by that focus on money rather than the focus on people. And your collective, your extended family.
Yeah, for sure. That's the, and then that makes us, susceptible to this spell even more so, because we're we're not operating as a healthy whole. We're operating as kind of fragmented.
Decapitated, like chickens without heads, is how I see it. And the people, the body, as degenerate as it is and as pathological as some of the symptoms are that it expresses, is still yet, as degraded as it has become, still has certain, McDonald calls them implicit whiteness, so certain things that it does, that it does want leadership. It wants representatives that will actually serve its interests, as amorphous as those interests are, as unspoken and as taboo as it is to even talk about those interests. That's what explains the groundswell of white support, at least for Trump. The fact that even non-whites seem to be flocking to him and think he's popular, I attribute to the fact that he is actually not a white racial aware guy. He's not speaking in racial terms, and that's why the non-whites feel perfectly safe in voting for him. They think he's just going to keep the system the way it is now, that they like the gravy train the way it is and they want to keep it going, and so that's why they're attracted to him. Whites, I think, are attracted to Trump because they see him at least stopping the slide, the very quick slide into oblivion that they sense at some deep level. Even as a kid, before I had any kind of thoughts, deep thoughts about race or any understanding of it, I think back and I recall having instincts, at least, that I was part of something larger, that the word white or whatever is as kind of unfavorable as it was even then, was basically how I thought of myself. And I looked at Europeans and I sympathized with Europeans. And I think basically most of, and this is me projecting a bit onto other white people, but I think a lot of white people are that way. It's not that they're just totally cat ladies or whatever. They are these horrible Antifa, self-hating whites. Certainly that's not even, I don't think that the self-hating is really an accurate description of it. Even the Antifa type, they don't hate themselves. They actually think very highly of themselves. They hate those other white people. And that's a very, very popular theme that's been tapped into in us. And I think it's really just a twisting of our natural healthy group awareness and need to be part of a group has been sort of hijacked and perverted into this. The group identity we have is to hate our own group, to despise our own group, to point at it and laugh and mock it and ridicule it and not feel sorry for it, to blame it for everything.
Well, that's the end of Section A, so I hope that you found that interesting. And if you did, you can find Section B on the channel here. Thanks very much.